Morning, folks.
Morning.
Let me pull up the chat thing. Looks like my broadband is achy this morning, so I want to make sure everybody can hear me.
We can hear you.
Good. If I do lose you for 30 seconds after I've lost you, so I'll go back and reset in those 30 seconds. So any questions? Your quiz is Wednesday, and I wanted to make sure if there are any questions to deal with at least some of them. But I will have an office hour tomorrow, I think 6 o'clock New York time. So that way, if you have any questions, it's cutting out. I don't know, something's wrong with my internet. I had a tough time even logging on. So I'm recording the session on my own computer. So if it turns out to be very choppy, I'll put that recording up as well. So let me get, any questions? No? No, I think it's a broadband at the same spirit theory here. So, last session, we ended the class. The quiz does go through everything through last Wednesday. So what we do today is on the quiz. So you relax and kind of ease up on yourself. So let's talk about where we left off last class. We were talking about the last principle in corporate finance, which is the dividend principle. And in a rational world, here's how you decide how much cash to return to the stockholders. Or if you're a private business, how much cash to take out of the business. Looking at the cash flows you from your operation and income, look at the statement of cash flows after you stopped off that first section. From that, obviously, you make the cash flows to debt. Whatever's left over is cash flows to equity investors. Some of that cash flow you're going to reinvest back into the business. And again, remember, reinvestment for the sake of reinvestment. There's no glory in it. You reinvest because you want to grow, because you have good projects. Whatever's left over after debt payments and reinvestment is called your free cash flow to equity. Fancy word, but think of it as potential dividends. The cash left over after you covered every conceivable need. Now, that free cash flow to equity might hold back, not again because you want to hold it back, because for precautions. You can have a bad year, you can have a crisis, and some of it you pay out. How you choose to pay out, you can either pay it out as dividends or buybacks. So you start with operations, investing, and then you make your debt payments, then you look to see what projects you can take with whatever's left over, and then whatever's left over of that, some of it you hold back and some of it you return. How much in stock buybacks and dividends will vary across companies. In a rational world, that's how dividend policy would be set up. Unfortunately, of all of the areas in corporate finance, dividends, I think, attract the most dysfunction. And here's what I mean by it. In most companies, instead of dividends being whatever's left over being returned to stockholders, here's what tends to happen. Companies decide how much to pay in dividends or how much to buy back upfront. You're saying that makes no sense. And lots of corporate finance doesn't make sense. You see, how do they decide how much to pay in dividends and how much to buy back? Easy. They look at what everybody else is doing. If everybody else is buying back stock, guess what they do? They buy back stock too. If everybody else is paying dividends, they pay dividends too. You're saying, what if they can't afford it? They reverse engineer what they need to do. So if you pay out too much in dividends or buy back too much in stock, guess what you do? You go out and borrow money to cover that, or you reject projects you should have taken. It's not a great way to run a business, but unfortunately, that's how dividend policy tends to work at most companies. So with that setup, let's talk about dividends specifically and how to characterize dividends. I'm going to talk about both dividends in the US and dividends globally as I go through this process, because there are some differences in how companies set dividends around the world, though there's a lot in common. If there's one word I would use to describe how companies pay dividends across the world, it's sticky. Sticky. You're saying, what does that mean? Most companies, if you look at what they pay in dividends this year, pay what they did last year. Dividends are sticky because most companies pay in dividends what they did the previous year. Even if they grow dividends, it's at a constant growth rate. It's almost like dividends are on autopilot. Let me back this up. This is a graph that looks at the percentage of companies every year that pay more in dividends, increased dividends, that's decreased dividends, that's a red line. So if I pause right there, far more companies increase than decrease dividends across time. But they're both outnumbered by the number of companies every year that pay the same amount in dividends. Most companies in most years pay what they did last year in dividends. You see, but what if there's a bad year? They should cut dividends, right? Well, the last quarter of 2008 should have been a test of this. It was the last big crisis. And during that crisis, it is true that more companies cut dividends than ever before, quarter four of 2008. But even in that horrifically bad quarter, notice the number of companies that increased dividends still outnumbered the number of companies that decreased dividends. We're going to come up in a quarter, the second quarter of 2020, which is going to be another test. And I'll make a prediction. All this talk about, you know, companies are going to massively cut dividends. You're not going to see every company in the S&P 500 or even most companies in the S&P 500 cut dividends, because the nature of dividends is they tend to be sticky. Why? Because companies hope that things will go back up, that they can return to paying dividends. And often they will use cash on hand to continue to pay dividends. So dividends are sticky. Let me pause there. And you know, if there are any questions, let me address them here. So at least in the US, dividends have been sticky. Most of the rest of the world shares that characteristic, with one exception. In Latin America, instead of dollar dividends or whatever the local current absolute dividends being sticky, dividend payout ratios tend to be sticky. You know what that means, right? Companies might not pay the same dollar amount in dividends, but they pay the same percentage of their earnings in dividends, which means in Latin America, dividends tend to jump around more. And the reason is very simple. Much of Latin America, you have two classes of shares, common shares and what are called preferred shares. But preferred shares are really non-voting common shares, but they get a fixed dividend. Part of the process here is to maintain dividend payout. So Rizwana says, if you don't pay dividends, is that a bad signal? We'll talk about signaling. Signaling is very, very tricky. In some companies, not paying dividends is a bad signal. In other companies, I'm going to argue that paying dividends can actually be a bad signal. Sounds weird, but we're going to come back and talk about what kinds of companies the signaling story works out on. But I want to make sure the sticky part of dividends comes through, that in most, and if you don't believe me, take your own company and look at their history. And what you're going to see is this very, 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 very uniform series of dividends, where dividends don't change much over time. Or if they do, they're going to change in a very predictable way. Here's the second aspect of dividends. Dividends tend to follow earnings. Key word here is they follow earnings. They don't lead earnings. They're not contemporaneous with earnings. They follow earnings. You can see that in this graph. The green is the earnings every year. The red is the dividends. Notice dividends are more stable than earnings. Even in 2009, when dividends dropped, they didn't drop by as much as earnings did. And essentially, they very quickly reverted back to steady state. But what I mean by following earnings is if you have a company that reports a big increase in earnings in a year, don't expect dividends to go up that year. If earnings go up 2 years in a row, maybe dividends will go up next year. If they go up 3 years in a row, you'll see a dividend increase in year three. Dividends tend to follow earnings. So if you're going to see effects from this crisis, maybe the effects will not be in 2020 right away. It might show up in 2021. Dividends tend to follow earnings. They don't lead earnings. They're not contemporaneous with earnings. And that brings me to the third aspect of dividends. Remember, I said there were two ways you can cash to stockholders. You can return in the form of dividends, or you can buy back stock. When you return cash in the form of dividends, your stock price will drop on the day of the dividends, called ex-dividend day. And we'll talk about why that has to happen. So when you pay dividends, what you're effectively doing is giving your stockholders a return in a different way, because there are two ways you get returns from stocks. One is price appreciation. The other is dividends. You're saying, what's the big deal? The way you get taxed on price appreciation or capital gains and the way you get taxed on dividends can be different. In much of the world, they're different. In the US, for much of the last century, you know which was taxed higher? Dividends or capital gains? I kind of give away the answer in that graph. It's actually been dividends. Dividends have been taxed as ordinary income. So you pay an ordinary income tax rate. So if you look across time, the tax rate on dividends have been 40, 50, even 70. It's been taxed at much lower rates. So across time, dividends have been taxed at a much higher rate than capital gains. In 2004 or 2002, in the first time after the Tax Reform Act got passed there, for the first time in probably a century, dividends and capital gains got taxed at the same rate. So you're saying this is good. They're both going to get taxed at the same rate. Tax law actually came with a sunset clause. You know what a sunset clause is? Because they could not get enough people in the Senate to vote for that law, they voted for the law to actually sunset after 10 years, which means everything they wrote in the law would disappear after the 10 years. Terrible way to write a tax law. But it's Congress. They wrote the law. So you're getting towards the end. I think it was 2012, towards the last quarter of 2012. That tax law that had been changed, where dividends were going to be taxed at the same rate as capital gains, was going to disappear, and dividends were going to revert back to be taxed at a much higher rate than capital gains. So this is your last quarter of low tax dividends. So guess what companies started doing in that quarter? They started pumping out more dividends in that quarter. In fact, I think Las Vegas Sands paid this record dividend to basically get cash out of the company. So the broader point I'm trying to make is whether you get paid dividends might be affected by tax law. And you can see that happen when you see these big changes in the tax law. So dividends and capital gains have been taxed at roughly the same rate now. So to make a long story short, I think in December 29th, 2 days left, Congress finally got around to fixing the tax law. So dividends and capital gains are still taxed at the same rate if it's long-term capital gains. If it's short-term capital gains, you might be taxed at ordinary income. But dividends and capital gains now get taxed, I think 20% is the current individual tax rate. But for a long time in US corporate history, dividends were taxed at a much higher tax rate than capital gains. And around the world, tax laws are different. UK and Australia have this feature to their tax laws, where if an investor receives dividends from a company, when you pay taxes, you're allowed to offset what the company has already paid in taxes. Remember the taxes that come out of net income, which is after-tax income. So what investors in the UK and Australia are allowed to do is, if you receive dividends from a company, you're allowed to take from the taxes you owe on those dividends, whatever taxes the company has already paid, which means dividends can become almost tax-free. You're going to see this play out when I show you what dividends look like in the UK and Australia, because UK and Australian companies tend to pay higher dividends, because from an investor perspective, there's an advantage there to receiving dividends as opposed to capital gains. So any questions about the tax issues and dividends will vary across the world. So the first thing to do when you have a company is to check the tax law in that country to see how dividends and capital gains are taxed. In India, for instance, for a long time, capital gains were not taxed and dividends were. So in fact, so you can get differences across countries, and you've got to be very, very aware at least of what those tax laws are. No questions on the tax issue? So now let's talk about what I think has been the biggest shift in dividends over the last four decades. If you go back to the early 1980s in the US, I think 95% of the cash returned by companies in 1981 took the form of dividends. You're saying, as opposed to what? As opposed to stock buybacks. Stock buybacks, when I first started looking at markets, were very rare and very unusual. Sometime in the mid 1980s, you started to see buybacks kick in. So in this graph, I'm actually going back to 1988. And even in 1988, dividends returned, the purple column, was much higher than capital gains. Than buybacks. But if you track them over time and you look at the percentage of cash, that's what this black line is, that's being returned in the form of buybacks across time, you can see the trend line. This isn't a recent phenomenon. For the last four decades, US companies have been shifting away from dividends towards buybacks. 2009, you got a short reversal because buybacks dropped back, but then you see very quickly buybacks come back. Now again, we're in the midst of a debate about dividends and buybacks. But before we get into that debate, I'd like to ask you a question. This is a huge trend, right? US companies, and this is not debatable, US companies have increasingly shifted from dividends to buybacks over the last four decades. Hacksaw can't be the answer because early on in this process, dividends actually have a bigger tax disadvantage. You could actually argue that if you just look at the tax law, companies should be shifting back towards dividends. So what's going on at US companies? It's not just US companies. It's a global phenomenon. You're starting to see this buyback shift across the world. So I'd like to ask, what do you think is going on here? Why do you think, at least for the US, companies have shifted increasingly from dividends to buybacks? Anybody? Ruksha, can you turn your mic on and...
From what I understand, dividend policy...
I'm sorry, I need something. I've lost my headphones. Let me put my headphones on. Sorry about that. No.
I was just saying that I think dividends are less flexible. Once you initiate a dividend, it's very
flexible. As my headphones come on, I will try to... So. You want to try another direction? It's going.
Okay.
Dividends
are once you...
Okay, I've lost my audio. Sorry about that. Rukshan said management. Rami said management compensation tied to stock price. Let's start with that one. That has a degree of truth to it. But if management compensation is tied to stock price, you know, why are you assuming that buybacks increase? You know, what is it about buybacks that leads you towards, you know, towards tie the two together? What is it about management compensation that makes buybacks more attractive than dividends to managers? When a company buys back stock, earnings per share go up, okay? So, but dividends go down. So your price goes up and you give enough dividends. So let's say you're a manager, I give you shares, okay? By buying back shares, your price appreciation increases, but your dividends have gone away. So it's got to be more than that. So there are two ways you can get management compensation. One is in the form of shares. What's the other? Options, right? So if you have options, you can see why maybe shifting to buybacks is better for you because options are entirely dependent on the stock price. Dividends don't help you. So one story that was told, at least in the 1990s, was that if managers got paid with options, let me see if I can shift my audio here because, no. I'm just going to switch out of my, and see if I can get the audio done because this is not good for me. Okay, now I think my speaker should be working. Tim, can you turn on your audio and see if the speakers are working?
Test, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Oh, it's working now. Okay, go ahead. So your argument is about the options as well, right? When you said stock price, it's strike price?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So Rami and Tim are onto something. Maybe it was the shift towards options in the 1990s pushing towards buybacks, but I'll play devil's advocate. If that were the case, then buybacks should be greatest at companies that had stock options and should not be a big deal at companies without. So I actually did a study in the 1990s to see if buybacks were greater at companies with options, very mild difference. So if it's a reason, it's a secondary reason. It's not the main reason. And that reason is in a sense gone away because since 2007, here's what's happened. Companies have shifted away from options to restricted stock. And with restricted stock, the argument no longer applies because there, if I use buybacks, I'm just taking away your dividends. Perry says companies feel stocks are undervalued. Come on, Perry. You had the greatest bull market in a long time in the last 12 years. Maybe early in the process in 2009, that could have been the case. But then why would he explain that buybacks peaked in 2018 and 19? I wish that were true. Now, Berkshire claims that it buys stock, and maybe it's one of the few companies that stay true to that notion. But the rest of the companies, I don't think the level of stock prices is what matters. Rukshan, can you come on again? Because there's something you mentioned in the chat that I want you to kind of elaborate. You said flexibility. Tell me more. What is it about buybacks that makes them more attractive to companies?
Well, I think relative to dividends are less flexible. Once you commit, it's a very strong signal. If you pull back or change your policy, so you kind of have to ride it out. Buybacks, you make a commitment, a looser commitment to buy back a certain amount over a period, and then you can time it. You can probably time it more to your advantage.
Yeah, I think in a sense that sticky kind of gets in the way, right? What do we say about dividends? Once you start paying dividends, you're stuck with them. Buybacks are flexible. Companies can announce that their buyback plans have changed in a second. In fact, in the last month, you've seen companies announce changes in their buyback plans, but very few companies have announced changes in their dividends. You're saying, but that's always been true. So what's been true in the last, because that's always been the case for the last 150 years. So why, starting in the 80s, building up through time, is this reason becoming a much stronger one? I mean, by the way, I don't know if it's, go ahead, Darshan.
So I was thinking that more investors nowadays are
working. I think my broadband, because I think.
Logged out.
Darshan, you're not on mute.
Yeah, I realized that. Can you hear me now? I'm sorry, let me see.
Yes.
Okay, let me share my screen again. I completely lost you. I don't know what's going on. Zoom's just killing me. Okay, let me put the recording back. Still recorded, so there'll be missing a few minutes. I think that, that the audio stays on. It's been, it is what it is. I'm going to open it. So if Again, I think I lost you again there. So I think Rukshan is on, still bad audio. How about now? I have no, well, if I turn my video off, you can't see the slides. So I don't think that's going to do the trick. Okay.
Professor, if you have a good ahead, mobile connection, you could use that to tether instead, perhaps?
Right. I might be jumping out of the frying pan into the fire. I've got to click out.
Or you can maybe just tell us what slide you're on.
So let me stay with that, right? It's, as I said, I'm sorry, Darshan, what do you join through phone or? I can stop the video. Can you guys hear me better now without the video?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me do it without the video then, because as I said, you got the slides, and I will make a recording so you can see it with the slides. So the bottom line here, though, is that flexibility has always been an issue, and buybacks have always been more flexible than dividends. So clearly, something's happened in the last 40 years. And I'll tell you what I think is driving this. It's good. So you can still see my slides. You just can't see me. Big deal. So not a big deal. You've seen me before. So if you think about the what's changed in the last 40 years, 40 years ago, if you asked me to list out 20 companies or even 100 companies, which had nice predictable earnings and protected markets that have no trouble. Today, in the age of disruption, it's very, very difficult to find a company which feels secure about its future. You say, what about a company like Coca-Cola? Hey, go talk to them. So what I think has happened in the last 3 or 4 decades is that companies have become less secure about their earnings. And as they get less secure about their earnings, they're getting more and more uncomfortable locking themselves into dividends that they can't afford to pay. So I think the shift towards buybacks, you know, people have all kinds of reasons for this, coming from something fundamental, a fundamental fear that earnings have become more unstable. So I know there are some people who argue that 2020, this crisis is going to make people go back to dividends. I think it's going to be the exact opposite. You know, 2020 is going to teach me. I don't want to be stuck paying dividends like ExxonMobil is right now, saying I have to pay these dividends through good times and bad. In fact, I'm going to tell you a little anecdote, which might be a little off color, but take it for what it's worth, which I think brings home the attraction, the difference between dividends and buybacks. So about 15 years, my daughter just turned 25 yesterday. So this was around her when she was about seven or eight. I was driving her to a birthday party, and she was tiny. So she gets in the back seat. She still had to be in a car seat. She was that small. And she demands that I turn, this is when I live in the East Coast, that I turn the radio to Z100, which is this New York City radio station that plays the same song over and over again. So I turn it on because even though she was small, she was very demanding. And the songs come out, and they're by people I've never heard of, reflection of my age. And then the DJs start talking to each other, and they talk about hooking up. And to show you how disconnected you get after 20 marriage, which is how long I'd been married then. I didn't know what hooking up was. And my daughter from the back seat starts to tell me what hooking up is. Part of me is in shock that my 7-year-old daughter is telling me these things. The other part of me is thinking, well, this is a great way to describe the difference between dividends and buybacks. You see the difference? Buybacks are like hooking up. Dividends are like getting married. You know, in good times and bad times, through the rest of your life, you've got to pay dividends. I think a lot more companies don't want to get married, and a lot more investors don't want to get married. I think buybacks are a reflection of the change in the fundamental relationship between companies and their investors. So the bottom line is, do I think that this is going to change? I think you're going to see a big drop in buybacks in 2020, and that's a good thing. I think you're going to see a big drop in buybacks in 2020, and that's a good thing. But I don't think you're going to see buybacks go away, because I think that fundamentally buybacks are a much healthier way for companies to return cash than dividends. And for those of you who think this is just a US phenomenon, it's not true. It's actually happening across the world, perhaps not to the extent. In the US, 60% of cash returned by companies in 2019 came from buybacks. But look across the world, Canada, 48%, the UK, 29%, Japan, 38%, even India, 19.4%. This is no longer just a US phenomenon. It's happening across the world, and there's a good reason for it, and that reason's not going to go away. So I know you're going to hear this dividends buybacks debate. We'll come back and talk a lot more about when it doesn't make sense to do buybacks and when it does. But I think you need to remember this fundamental reason why we've shifted towards buybacks. They're flexible dividends, and we need more flexibility, not less flexibility, as companies start to deal with these crises. Any questions?
Any specific reason why China is so low? Any specific reason why China is so low on buybacks?
China is so low is because of corporate governance. Chinese companies first have very high growth and very bad corporate governance. And both of those factors play into cash return. If you have very high growth, you have less cash to return. And if you have terrible corporate governance, nobody can force you to return the cash. So China and much of Asia, I think buybacks are low simply because less cash is returned by those companies. The companies just hold on to the cash. Any questions or comments?
Professor, if there wasn't the perception of dividends being sticky, then is there any other difference? Like, is there any...
No, in fact, if dividends were more flexible, I think that we wouldn't have a problem. But I think there's a history for dividends that reflects why they're sticky. What came first, stocks or bonds? In terms of financial markets, you know, which market had its foundations first? Was it the bond market or the stock market?
Bond market.
The bond market came first. So when stocks were first offered to investors, this was like the 1800s, and the stock markets were taking off from the ground, you know how people package stocks? They package them as glorified bonds. The only way they could get investors to invest in stocks was by offering them something that looked like coupons. So the history of dividends reflects the history of stocks. Unfortunately, that history makes dividends sticky. So if you could make dividends flexible, so I have no problem replacing buybacks with special dividends. I think that's okay. So if you could make dividends flexible, then I think the need for buybacks would go away. But unfortunately, the minute I say dividends, investors think sticky. And that perception is very difficult to alter.
Got it, thank you.
Okay. So let's talk about, Emily, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a quick question about why the payout ratio in Australia is the highest. Is that because like we have very like few big companies that are like monopoly in the market, and our market is not that mature compared to the US?
What type of companies dominate the Australian and Canadian markets? It's natural resource companies, right? Remember what we talked about natural resource companies? Basically, the earnings of these companies go up and down with the price of the commodity, right? And commodity prices have had a tough, it's not just 2020, have had a tough 5 years. Since 2013, commodity prices have stayed low. So earnings for these companies has dropped, but these companies are stuck paying dividends. This is the problem with sticky dividends, right? Basically, you get stuck with dividends and your earnings have dropped and you continue to pay those dividends. So that's one reason. The other is, remember I talked about Australian and UK companies, investors having that advantage of not having to pay taxes on dividends? That's also driving dividend policy. So there are a couple of good reasons and a couple of unhealthy reasons why this is happening. But I think that best explains why the payout ratio is so high.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor. So it's more like an industry structure issue rather than the company's choice.
Exactly. So sometimes when you have a market dominated by certain types of industries, you can see dividend policy affected by what's happening in those industries.
Thank you.
And in fact, that notice that the dividend, when we talk about payout and yield, you're going to see payout and yield numbers across the world, and you're going to see the US has some of the lowest dividend yields. And at first sight, you say that is terrible, but remember also that the US has the highest percentage of its value coming from tech companies, which tend to be high growth, uncertain earnings. So these differences across markets can explain a lot of differences in dividend policy. So let's talk about measuring how much your company pays in dividends. There have been two conventional measures of how much companies pay in dividends. One is your payout ratio. The payout ratio measures the percentage of your net income that gets paid out in dividends. So if you have $100 net income and you pay out 50, your payout ratio is 50%. You're saying, what if my net income is negative and I still pay dividends? Then your payout ratio becomes not meaningful because you can't compute it. The dividend yield is the dividends you pay divided by a market cap. So if you have a $100 stock price on which you have a $2 dividend, your dividend yield is 2%. They're the two most widely used measures of dividends. And I'm going to show you what the numbers look like across the world, but each measures something very different. The payout ratio measures how much of your earnings you're taking out of the company. So that payout ratio is a measure of how much you put back as well, because whatever you don't pay out gets reinvested. The dividend yield measures the return you make as a stockholder from that company just purely from dividends. So let's look at what these two numbers look like across the world and across regions. First, let's look at payout ratio. If you look at the payout ratio around the world, the global average, it's better probably talk about medians because it's a skewed distribution. The median payout ratio across the world is about 30 to 40%. So among companies that pay out dividends, and I want to focus on just dividend paying firms, and you're going to see in a minute why I do that. Among dividend paying firms, if you ask me what the median payout ratio is, it's about 20 to 30% for US companies, for both US and global companies. That's the median payout ratio. But you can see that there are some companies that pay out a lot more, 60%, 70%, 80%. So even among dividend paying firms, there are some companies that actually have payout ratios greater than 100% in 2019. So let me pause right there. Are these companies crazy? I mean, why would a company pay out more than 100% of its earnings as dividends? And I can think of at least three good reasons. Let's see if you can find all three. What are the three scenarios where a company might pay out more than 100% of its earnings as dividends and still be a sane company? Rami says they borrow money to pay dividends, but I said, borrowing money to pay dividends would make sense if you're an under-levered company. Remember we did the leverage part? No. They have lots of cash on the balance sheet, yes, but they can't keep doing this, right? No good projects. Okay, so let's, Siddharth and Nico have a good point. So Siddharth, you want to unmute yourself and talk about what you mean when you say no good projects? Finish that story for me. Why would that lead to a more than 100% payout ratio? What are you doing?
So if a company has good corporate governance and if they see that they do not have any projects that are like that have positive NPV or like good IRR, they would better...
Siddharth, let me add to that. And they don't see any good projects on the horizon because... Yeah. So you're in a bad business, then what are you doing?
But they are ultimately paying off the shareholders, right? Because they have good corporate governance, they're not.
They're saying we're in a bad business, we're going to make ourselves a smaller company.
Yeah.
And I think that makes sense. So the first scenario where you should see payout ratios greater than 100% is you want to shrink your company. Why are you shrinking your company? Because you're in a bad business. Imagine how much value GE stockholders would have got if 15 years ago or 10 years ago, they'd look forward and said, we're in bad businesses. We need to get smaller. So that's the first scenario. Second, but Rami and David both mentioned borrowing money and lots of cash. You can use that to explain the higher payout ratio if you expect your earnings to bounce back. So if you're a commodity company and oil prices are down, but you think oil prices will come back up, you might pay more than 100% of your current year's earnings as dividends on the expectation that those earnings will bounce back. So that's the second explanation, is you're expecting your earnings to bounce back. And this was just a bad year. And there's a third one. Remember when we talked about optimal debt ratio, we talked about some companies are underlevered. And one of the strategies we said you could adopt if you're underlevered and you don't want to do something right away is you can pay out more in dividends and over time push up your debt ratio. You know, so if you take Rami's suggestion and borrow money to pay dividends and you do it over 5 or 10 years and you have a payout ratio greater than 100%, you can push your debt ratio up over time. So those are the three circumstances where having a payout ratio greater than 100% can be explained. You're in a bad business and you want to make yourself smaller. Second is you just had a bad year, you expect to bounce back. And the third is you're underlevered, and this is a long-term strategy you've adopted to bring your equity down and to bring your debt ratio up. So these companies are not necessarily crazy, but some are crazy. Some are paying out more than 100% earnings and dividends because they're stuck in a dividend policy they cannot sustain. So sticky dividends can sometimes lead you to insane dividend policies that can drive you into the ditch. Now, incidentally, if you look at across the world, you can see why I said just dividend paying funds. Here's a nice trick question to ask. Now, many of you are going to be on the other side of the interview table next year or 2 years from now. What I mean by that is you're going to be working somewhere and, you know, and coming back to business school and interviewing other people. And let's say you're interviewing a really cocky person who seems to, who thinks they know everything. Here's a nice trick question to ask. What is the median dividend payout ratio for a U.S. company? What is the median dividend payout ratio for a U.S. company? What's the right answer to that question? And don't just look at this graph, look at the table as well. What's the median dividend payout ratio for a U.S. company? What's the definition of median? It's a 50th percentile, right? Look at the number of U.S. companies that pay dividends and the number of companies which are dividend payers. The median payout ratio is going to be way below 30%. In fact, in some years, it's going to be 0%. In fact, I'll make a wager that the median payout ratio this year is going to be 0%. A lot more companies across the world are starting to not pay dividends, and increasingly the payout ratio is going to converge on 0%. So that's why I separate companies into dividend payers and non-dividend payers, because the number of non-dividend payers is getting larger and larger. And across time, I wouldn't be surprised if the median company in the world is not paying dividends anymore. Doesn't mean they don't return cash. They might do buybacks instead of dividends, but the median payout ratio is very quickly converging on zero. I also looked at dividend yields. And here again, you can see the median dividend yield. So the dividend yield across all U.S. companies is 1.68%. That is close to the lowest. The lowest actually is India. That surprised me. Lowest dividend yield in the world is India. And that's dividends divided by market cap. And there are two things that can force the dividend yield down. One is that you're not paying much in dividends. The other is your market cap gets pushed up way over the top. Whatever the reason, the dividend yield today across the world is far lower than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Even the markets which have the highest dividend yields, which are Africa and the Middle East, Australia, New Zealand, have lower dividend yields today than they did 10 or 20 years ago. In fact, if you look at the dividend yield for US stocks, it used to be 4% in 1980 or 81. Now it's down to 1.68%. A lot of old-time value investors look at just that number and say, hey, I told you so, stocks are overpriced. What's the pushback against it? How would you explain the big drop in dividend yields over the last 40 years and then draw the conclusion that that by itself doesn't tell you stocks are overpriced? What should I compare that dividend yield to? Darshan?
I was thinking that the numerators have not changed, but the denominators have.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that just explains why the dividend yield is lower. You're still playing into the hands of the value investor saying, well, if the numerator hasn't changed, why are you pumping up the denominator? What is your alternative to buying stocks? If, as an investor, let's say you are risk averse, you don't want to buy stocks. What do you buy instead?
Bonds.
Bonds, right? And if you want to take no risk at all, you buy T-bonds.
Treasuries, yeah.
In 1981, you know what the T-bond rate was in the U.S.? It was 9%. So stocks offered 4%, but bonds offered 9%. Forget about even the 2020 crisis. Even before the crisis, what was the dividend yield in the U.S.? I'm sorry, what was the T-bond rate at the start of this year. Slightly less than 2%. Now, do you see why just looking at the dividend yield in isolation across time tells you absolutely nothing? The dividend yield is low, but so are the alternatives. Money as an opportunity cost. And as inflation has come down and the T-bond rate has come down, of course the dividend yield is also going to come down. So if you hear anybody saying, you know, the dividend yields are low, therefore stocks are overpriced, push back. That by itself tells you absolutely nothing. But there seem to be nice, some great investments to be had, right? There are some companies out there that have 7.5%, 8.5% dividend. In fact, last week I computed a list of at least 50 companies with dividend yields greater than 10%. This must be, would you put your money in those 50 stocks? I mean, these look like great returns, right? The T-bond rate is what, close to 0.5%, 0.6%. You're buying stocks with a 10% dividend yield. Isn't this good? I mean, what is the danger in investing in stocks with dividend yields of 7, 8, 9, 10% right now?
Are those backwards looking yields?
They are, right? There are no, I mean, in a sense, all I'm using is expected dividends. And until a company announces they're going to cut dividends, that's a dividend you're stuck with. All dividend yields are based on announced dividends. So I think, David, you're on to the next point, which is many of these companies, what should you expect to see in the next year?
Yeah, those companies at 7, 8, 9% to cut their dividends and or go bankrupt if they're in the energy space and return to the middle.
Yeah. In fact, most of the big chunk of these companies are banks and oil companies. They look great on a dividend yield basis. So your concern with these companies is you're buying them because you're expecting a 9% dividend yield, but that's based on dividends last year. And you should not be surprised to wake up to huge dividend cuts of these companies. That said, though, there's a subset of these companies where I'll take my chances. I'll buy Aramco if I could. I can't buy Aramco. Aramco has promised a $75 billion dividend. They have no debt. They have lots of cash. They're going to be around for the long term. I might even buy ExxonMobil or Royal Dutch. ExxonMobil over Royal Dutch. ExxonMobil has very little debt, has lots of cash. And if they think dividends are sticky and they don't cut dividends, I might be able to collect these dividends. So there's a subset of these companies where you might be able to get your dividends. But just because a dividend yield is high, don't go buy the stock, because you might also be buying, you know, in fact, Nico brings this up, a depreciation in your stock price as those dividends get paid. Because if you're a company in trouble and you continue to pay dividends, you're going to drive your stock price into a ditch. So dividend yields are used a lot by value investors, and I have no problem with that. But sometimes when they're used blindly, they can get you into trouble. So any questions on dividend payout ratios and dividend yields? Because, you know, you might want to look at those two numbers for your company. And if you see zero for both numbers, don't be surprised. A policy of not paying dividends is still a dividend policy. You still have to explain whether that policy makes sense. And in fact, you're probably closer to the typical company if you don't pay dividends than if you do. Any other questions on dividend payout or yield? So let me do a very quick run at how you can explain differences in dividends across companies. I'm going to use a structure you've seen before. Remember that life cycle I used to explain why companies should have different debt ratios at different stages? I said young companies shouldn't borrow money. As you mature, your debt capacity improves, and then you go into decline. You've got to manage your debt capacity. You can use exactly the same life cycle story to explain shifts in dividends, and it's very intuitive. If you're a young startup, how much cash should you return to your stockholders? Yeah, it's just absolutely nothing. What cash? You're a negative cash flow company. As you're a young growth company, you're still cash flow negative. You shouldn't be paying dividends. You continue to grow, you should hold back on dividends. You have uncertain earnings, your reinvestment needs are high. As you become a mature company, your capacity to return cash improves. Whether you do it in the form of dividends or buybacks is up to you. And then you go into decline, you're the kind of company with a payout ratio greater than 100%. So here's what you should expect to see. If you can put your company in the life cycle where it is, you should at least have a sense of, should this company be returning a big chunk of its cash, a small chunk of its cash, or no cash, based on where it is in the life cycle. Very simplistic way of thinking about dividend policy, but it actually works very well. And just to back it up, let me show you a graph. A couple of years ago, I broke down global companies based on growth rates, expected growth rates in the future from very low to very high growth rates. Then I looked at how much they paid in dividends. And I used, as I think, as my measure of dividend, both dividend payout ratios and dividend yields. So as you go from low growth to high growth, there's no surprises. Your payout ratio gets lower, your dividend yield gets lower. What do I get out of this? Let's say you're looking at a high growth company. Your company is Netflix, or it's Tesla, or it's, you know, pick any high growth company. And you ask me, how much should I expect to see in dividends in this company? My answer is, given their growth, I shouldn't expect to see much in dividends or buybacks. So if you have a company that's a high growth company and you see a big buyback, that doesn't make sense. If you're a low growth company and no cash is being returned, that doesn't make sense either. And in corporate finance, it's looking for those mismatches that drive us towards, hey, maybe companies should be doing things differently. It's in fact, if you think about activist investors, one of the things that triggers activist investors is a company that doesn't act its age. What I mean by that, a mature company that doesn't return any cash. Carl Icahn is at your door saying, why are you guys doing this? In fact, Apple in 2011 and 2012 had to get pushed to start returning cash to stockholders. Why? Because they never returned cash. They used to be a high growth company. They'd become a mature company, but they didn't want to admit to it. So it takes companies a push sometimes to accept the fact that they're now no longer young growth companies and they can return cash. And when that happens, you should see more cash returned. Any questions on either the dividend yield part or this growth graph? So let me look at what the dividend yields and payout ratios are for my five companies, Disney, Vale, Tata Motors, Baidu, and Deutsche Bank. Those are my five public companies. I've reported the dividend yield in the trailing 12 months. So this is dividends divided by earnings in the last 12 months. I computed the payout ratio in the last 12 months. So that's dividends divided by the trailing income. I'm sorry, dividend yield is dividends divided by the stock price. Dividend payout ratio is dividends divided by earnings. So the last 12 months. I've also reported the average over the last 5 years. With Disney, not a big deal. Those two numbers look very similar, right? Nick, you have a question? No? Okay. No. For Vale, the dividend yield and payout ratio look outlandish, right? Huge yield, huge payout ratio. But remember what we said about commodity companies, that they try to normalize things? Its yield and payout ratio look a little more reasonable if you look at the average across time. Rizwana, go ahead.
My question is with regards to mature companies. Given the trend towards buyback has increased, so won't we see the same trend for mature companies as well, where they won't be paying as high?
That graph is not just about dividends, it's about cash return. I should be a little more specific. So all that graph says is more cash should be returned by mature companies. Whether they do it in dividends or buybacks will vary. But to the extent that more mature companies have more stable income, you might see So the mix of dividends and buybacks can vary across mature companies, but you'd expect them all to return more cash than they did when they were growth companies.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So with Vale and Deutsche Bank, what you see are big differences between what you see in the trailing 12 months and what you saw as an average. What that means is if your earnings have had a bad year, often your dividend yield and payout ratio are going to pop at you. Why? Because you're sticking with your old dividends when your earnings have collapsed. Deutsche, it's actually almost insane, right? 362% payout ratio. What was Deutsche hoping for in 2013? That its net income would go back to normal. You know what happened in the following 3 years? Anybody track the history of Deutsche? Did their earnings go back to normal? Deutsche went from bad to worse. So in 2016, they finally cut dividends to zero. 2016. It took them 8 years of consecutive bad years before they finally said, guys, we can't afford to do this anymore. That's what I mean by sticky. I mean, dividend policy, especially at banks, I think is insane. In 2009 and 2010, when banks continued to pay dividends, my reaction was, what's wrong with you guys? I actually talked to the CEO of a pretty large bank. I said, why are you guys continuing to pay dividends? Your regulatory capital is in shambles. You're losing money. You know what his answer was? we don't want to send a bad signal. I said, what universe are you guys living in? Every day I open up the newspaper and I see bad news stories about you. You don't need, when you don't cut dividends, you know the signal you're sending? You're in denial. You're in trouble. You might as well accept you're in trouble and cut dividends. If I were advising an oil company or a bank today, I'd say, do it quickly. Do it now. When everybody knows you're in a crisis, come out. If JP Morgan came out and said, hey, we're suspending dividends for the next year because we want to see what happens, would you be surprised? No, I wouldn't. And I don't think that, I think people overestimate the signaling story and they often overreact when it comes to dividend policy by sticking with old dividends. But if you're a big company and everybody knows you're in trouble, just accept you're in trouble. Make the change in dividends quicker, because the longer you wait, the more difficult it gets. Rizwana. No, okay. So any questions? So let's talk about how to set dividend policy. There are three schools of thought in dividend policy, and they kind of span the spectrum. The first school, in a world where you have no tax differences between dividends and capital gains, and companies can go out and issue stock without any transactions costs, issuance costs or flotation costs, it does not matter what you pay in dividends. What does that mean? If you pay a big dividend, here's what's going to happen. Your stockholders will get more of the return from dividends, less from price appreciation, but they'll get the same total return. Your dividend policy becomes irrelevant. Hey, does that remind you of something that we talked about a few sessions ago? What else did we say was irrelevant? In a world with no taxes, no default risk, and no agency costs, we said it doesn't matter how much you borrow, right? That's Milla Modigliani 1. This is Milla Modigliani 2. In a world with no tax differences between dividends and capital gains, and we can raise equity, dividends don't matter. If you lived in a Milla Modigliani world, we could have cut this class short after the middle of the semester, after we finish capital budgeting. Because in a Milla Modigliani world, it's the quality of your investments that matters. Capital structure and dividend policy don't matter. I know people laugh at the Milla Modigliani word, but you know what? There's a fundamental truth to what they say. If you think about great companies and how they become great, they don't become great by finessing capital structure or defining dividend policy. They get great by taking great investments. Think of Apple, Facebook, Google, GM in its glory days. If you're focused on capital structure and dividend policy, you've already lost the big battle, right? Because it's an investment policy where value creation happens. That's what I take out of Milla Modigliani. I know that the assumptions they make to arrive at capital structure and dividend policy or relevance are strong ones. But I think of them as the limiting case. But there is a school of thought that says it doesn't matter how much you pay in dividends. You can pay no dividends, big dividends, it doesn't matter. We'll come back and address that school. So we'll start with that. The second school of thought had a huge following, especially in the last century. Remember in the last century, I said in the US at least, dividends were taxed at a much higher tax rate than capital gains. So the second school of thought says there's a huge tax disadvantage to dividends, so companies should not pay dividends. Dividends are bad. So dividends don't matter, dividends are bad. So this school of thought says don't pay dividends. You can buy back stock if you need to, but paying dividends is a bad thing. And there's a third school of thought, kind of rounds out the schools. The third school of thought says, if you have investors who like dividends, like whom? Older investors, pension funds, people who like dividends. Just like the customer's always right. As a company, the investor's always right. If your investor clientele, the type of investors who buy a stock like dividends, guess what? You should pay more in dividends. If you're a CFO, this is extremely convenient. Right? Because no matter what you do, there's an entire school of thought backing you up. If you increase dividends, you point to the third school, dividends are good. If you cut dividends, you point to the second school, dividends are bad. If you have no idea what you're doing about dividends, you say you're in the Milla Modigliani school, because it doesn't matter. So let's take each of these three schools, because they can't all be right at the same time, because they're saying three different things. So here's how I get my dividend assessment by looking at these three schools of thought. If you have lots of cash and very few good investments, then I think you should be returning more cash to your stockholders. Does that make sense? If you have lots of cash coming in from your operations, you don't have very good investments, then return more cash. If you don't have very much cash and you have lots of good investments, then you shouldn't be returning cash. Sounds to me a common sense way to think about dividend policy, right? We'll come back and put some structure on these questions, but that seems to be what I get out of these three schools of thought. So let's take a closer look at each of these three schools of thought and see why they arrive at the conclusions that they do. Let's start with the dividends don't matter school, and let's see how they arrive at the conclusion. So for this school of thought to work, you first have to have no difference between dividends and capital gains. So as an investor, if you get 11% return on stocks, you're indifferent as to whether the entire 11% comes from capital gains or whether 6% comes from capital gains and 5% from dividends or 8% from dividends. In other words, 11%, as long as you get the 11%, you don't care whether you get it in dividends or capital gains because you get taxed the same way and more. So that's the first part. The second is, in this school of thought, if your company pays too much in dividends, here's what the company does. It goes out and issues shares, raise equity, and takes the same projects at a debt. So in the Minimodigliani school, we start with the presumption that the projects that companies take are the same, no matter what your dividend policy is. They're all positive net present value projects. And if you pay too much in dividends, you just make it up by issuing stock. So in this school of thought, here's what happens. Investors get the same total return on their stock, no matter what the dividend policy is. All it does is change the mix of dividends and capital gains. So the Miller-Modigliani school says, hey, don't spend too much time assessing dividends. Just set a dividend, and if it's too high, just go make up for it by issuing stock. Your stockholders will not care. Now, obviously, that school of thought gets pushed back, especially in the last century, because of the tax difference that was right in front of us. Remember I said dividends for a long time have been taxed at a much higher rate than capital gains. And here's what. Dividends have for much of the last century have been taxed as ordinary income. So the ordinary income tax rate in the US is the purple line. Capital gains have been taxed at this blue rate. So think about being in 1960. Dividends were taxed at a 90% tax rate. That's what ordinary income was. Capital gains were taxed at 25%. You can see the basis for the dividends of bad school, right? So if I give you dividends, you get taxed at a 90% tax rate, but if you get capital gains, you get 25%. The question you're asking, why would you ever pay dividends? We'll come back and look at the answer to it, but you can see that the basis for the school is, for much of the last century, dividends were taxed at a much higher tax rate. There's a brief period after the 1986 tax reform where the difference disappeared, but then it reappeared again with the Clinton Tax Reform Act. Then it disappeared again in 2004. At least on the surface, the dividend tax disadvantage has gone away. But I'm going to argue that even though the tax rates and dividends and capital gains have converged, there's still a tax disadvantage to dividends. Can somebody tell me what that tax disadvantage is? The tax rate right now on dividends and capital gains has converged on 20% for both. Why is there still tax
disadvantage? Pay taxes on dividend this year, but on capital gains, you'll pay it when the gain arises.
There's a timing issue, right? Dividends, you have to pay taxes. You don't have a choice. When I did my taxes this year, I could have taken under July 15th. I actually did it by April 15th. I had to pay taxes on all the dividends I received last year. I can't go to the IRS and say, guys, can I wait 7 years? I'm still holding on to the stock. Capital gains, I decide when I take the tax because it doesn't happen until I actually sell the stock. There's a timing advantage. You say, so what? If your income goes up and down over time and your tax rates vary across time, mine doesn't vary that much, but let's say it varies across time. You know when you should take your capital gains? When your income is high or when your income is low?
Low.
When you should take when your income is low. That's the timing advantage. So even though the tax rates have converged, there's still a little bit of a disadvantage in dividends because of the timing issue. So the dividends are bad school still as a basis, but that basis has become much smaller. So let's build on this notion of dividends and how it plays out in stock prices. Now, if you have ever invested in stocks for a long period, there's a day on when you think about dividends, there are 3 days associated with dividends that you've got to track. One is the announcement day, which is when the board of directors gets together and announces what the company is going to pay out as dividends. That's a day on which markets react to the information that your dividends are going to be different. So next week, Delta Airlines announces suspending dividends for the next year. That's the announcement day. The stock price reacts. That's the information day. Then there is a day called the ex-dividend day. You know what the ex-dividend day is? It's the day by which you got to buy the stock if you want to collect the dividends. In the old days, it was the day the company actually closed the books physically, and the stockholders on that day received the check in the mail. That's the ex-dividend day. And then there's the payment day. That's the actual day the check actually arrives in your mailbox. The announcement day is where there's information. The ex-dividend day is the day on which ownership of the dividend passes. The payment day is the day you actually get the check. You know, which of these 3 days is the most pointless? The payment day, then nothing happens. There's no information. Even on the ex-dividend day, there's no information because you know what the dividend is going to be, but there is going to be a price effect. And to see why, let me set up the process. Let's assume that we're all stockholders in a company and we bought shares in the company 5 years ago at a price. Let's call that price P. Right? So we bought stock in the company long time ago at P, and we're all stockholders. Tomorrow is going to be the ex-dividend day. We know what the dollar dividend is going to be tomorrow because remember that announcement was made a long time ago. So we know what the dollar dividend, there's no uncertainty. So let's say the dollar dividend tomorrow is going to be a dollar. Now it's going to be $1.50. We have two choices. We can sell the stock before the ex-dividend day at PB. So let's call that price. And give up the dividend, or wait through the ex-dividend day and sell at PA. What's your first reaction? Why would I ever want to sell before the ex-dividend day? Well, PB and PA can be different. In fact, they should be different. If they're not different, we have a problem. Because then everybody will buy the stock just before the ex-dividend day, collect the dividend, and sell at the end of the ex-dividend day. So there has to be something that happens to the stock price to prevent that free money from happening. So let's see what the relationship is going to be between PB and PA. And to do this, I'm going to bring in two different tax rates. The first is your tax rate on dividends. Remember the old days, it was much higher than the tax rate on capital gains. So I'm going to call that TO. And the second is the tax rate on capital gains. So the cash flows from selling before the ex-dividend day will be as follows. I will make PB. And I'll have to pay capital gains on the difference between PB and what I originally paid for the stock times the capital gains tax rate. You're saying, where's the dividend? Remember, by selling before the ex-dividend date, I've given up on the dividend. So that's going to be my cash flow from selling before. If I wait through the ex-dividend day, I get PA. I have to pay capital gains taxes on PA. But now I collect the ordinary dividend net of ordinary taxes. So that's my cash flow from selling before. This is my cash flow from selling after. For a market to be stable, you know what I mean by stable, where everybody's not trying to sell or nobody's trying to sell. For most investors, those two cash flows have to be equal. In other words, you have to be indifferent between selling before and selling after. I want to make sure everybody gets that, because if for everybody the cash flow from selling before was higher than from the cash flow from selling after, you'd have an unstable market. Everybody would try to sell before. And for everybody, the cash flow from selling after is higher than before, nobody would sell before. So for most investors, these two numbers have to be equal. Think of this as the marginal investor. So for the marginal investor, the two cash flows have to be equal. So I'm going to set these two equal. You say, where is this going? Hang in there. I'm going to do some algebra. For the market to be stable, here's what the algebra leads me to. The change on the ex-dividend day in the stock price as a percent of the dividend has to reflect the difference in tax rates. In other words, if I get taxed at exactly the same tax rate on dividends and capital gains, the stock price drop on the ex-dividend day has to be roughly equal to the dividend. Remember the $1.50 dividend? The stock price has to drop by roughly $1.50. To the degree that there's a tax difference, you're going to see a difference in how much the stock price drops. So if dividends get taxed at a higher rate than capital gains, the stock price drop has to be less than the dividend. If the dividends are taxed at a higher tax rate than capital gains, the price will actually drop by more than the dividend. So I know there's a lot of algebra here, but I want you to get the intuition here of why the ex-dividend day stock price is telling you something about how dividends and capital gains are being taxed. Any questions on what I'm doing here? Basically, I'm setting up the cash flows equal and solving for that break-even point. So if there are no questions, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to observe the price change on the dividends. So let's say you come to me with a company and say, hey, do investors in my company get taxed at a higher tax rates on dividends than capital gains? My answer is, I don't know, but I can tell you at least based on the ex-dividend day behavior, what most investors in your company think about dividends. Here's what I'm going to do with your company. I'm going to take the stock price and the ex-dividend day, not on one ex-dividend day, but perhaps over 20. I'm going to look at the price change on the ex-dividend day, and I'm going to compare it to the dividend. If I find that across the 20x dividend days, the price change is roughly equal to the dividend, I'm going to come back to you and say, in your company, investors are pretty indifferent between dividends and capital gains when it comes to tax differences. Why? Because the price change is roughly equal to the dividend. If I find instead that the price change is less than the dividend, I'm going to argue that in your company, investors are taxed more highly on dividends and capital gains, because that's what leads to that conclusion. If the price change is greater than the dividend, I'm going to say the reverse. So I'm going to observe the price change in the ex-dividend day compared to the dividend and use it as a basis for drawing conclusions about what most investors in your company think about dividends. Does everybody get the intuition behind what I'm doing? I'm taking what I can observe, which is what the price does in the ex-dividend day comparing it to dividends. So this is actually a phenomenon that's been studied by academics in finance going back 50 years. The very first study was run by a couple of professors who used to teach at Stern, Ned Elton and Marty Gruber. They were legends at the school. And they actually computed, this was using data from 66 to 69, that the price change as a percent of the dividend was about 78%. What does that mean? If you have a dollar dividend, the stock price dropped by roughly 78 cents. Well, in those days, dividends also got taxed at a much higher tax rate than capital gains. So that was their conclusion. It makes sense. As because dividends get taxed at a higher rate, the price change is smaller than the dividend. That study was updated in the 1980s. The price change as a percent of dividends had increased from 78 to 85%, but the tax difference had also narrowed. It was still there, but dividends were being taxed at 50%, capital gains were being taxed at 20%. Then it was updated in the early 90s. By then, the tax rate on capital gains and dividends had converged. And the price change as a percent of dividend hadn't gone to 100%. It had gone up to 90%. And your reaction is, if the taxes are the same, why isn't this 100%? Remember we talked about the timing differences? That timing difference, I think, still persists. Now, this study, the most recent one I saw, came out in the mid part of the last decade, 2014 or 15. That price change is now up to 96 or 97%. It's not up to 100% still, but it's up to 96 or 97%. And one reason it's happening is this difference between the dividend and the price change is opening the doors for some people to create what's dividend arbitrage or dividend capture. And to see what dividend arbitrage or capture is, let me do a little what if for you. Let's say you're a tax exempt investor. You're saying, who the heck is tax exempt? Pension funds are tax exempt. Nonprofits are tax exempt. Endowments are tax exempt. So let's say you're a tax exempt investor. You're the NYU endowment fund. Or if you want a richer endowment fund, the Yale endowment fund. And you're looking at a stock where you expect the dividend to be a pretty big one. And let's say the dividend is going to be $2 tomorrow. And based on your assessment of this company's ex-dividend day price behavior, you think the price drop is going to be nearly 90% of the dividend. So that you know there's going to be a big dividend, and you know the price is going to drop 90% of the dividend. You're tax exempt. You pay no taxes on dividends, no taxes on capital gains. How would you take advantage of this phenomenon? Assuming that you believe that 90% is right, you know what the dividend is, you make some easy money here. What would you do? Let me give you some choices. Would you invest in the stock for the long term? No, why? Well, you know, it doesn't make much sense. Perry, what would you do?
I would buy the stock at $100 today, sell it at $99.10 tomorrow, assuming $1 dividend.
Yeah. In other words, you'd hold it for a day, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. You'd collect the dividend, you'd lose the price drop, you'd make the difference. In fact, you don't even have to hold it for a day. There are ways in which you can trade on this where you can try to reduce it to, you can reduce the timing risk you run, because even with a day, there's a timing risk. Why? Because the day you do it might be a horrific day. I remember a story, and it's a horror story, about a pension fund investor it was a state pension fund investor in the 1980s, who read the study in the Journal of Finance about the ex-dividend. He decides he's going to play this game. She takes 30% of the pension fund and he buys one stock just before the ex-dividend day. And the day happened to be October 19th of 1987. So what's he doing? He's buying the stock saying, tomorrow's going to be my ex-dividend day. I'm going to collect the difference and it's going to be easy money. You know what happened on October 19th of 1987? The S&P 500 dropped 22%. It was a black Monday. 22%. What do you think happened to this guy? He wiped out almost 10% of his pension fund on one day. He got fired, obviously. But if you're going to do this across lots of stocks. Don't do it with 30% of your fund. And this is called dividend capture arbitrage, and companies do it all the time. And the way this will work is, they do it in millions of shares. So let's say you have a stock where the stock is trading at $50, right? Tomorrow's going to be an ex-dividend day, dollar. You'd buy a million shares, cum dividend. That's what it's called if you buy it just before the ex-dividend day for 50. You wait till the stock goes ex-dividend. You sell the stock on an expected basis for 49.1 and you make 100,000. You say only 100,000, then buy 10 million shares, 100 million shares. So often you would see, especially on ex-dividend days, huge jumps in trading volume on big dividend stocks. Look, so if you track a utility stock or a bank stock, look at ex-dividend days. You'll see a much bigger trading volume. And what that trading volume reflects is this dividend capture game going. The only thing is, the more people playing this game, the closer towards one that price change is going to become, right? In other words, your price change is going to converge on the dividend. But dividend capture and dividend arbitrage reflect the fact that you have different investors in the same market with very different tax statuses. Any questions on dividend capture arbitrage? Which brings me to, can we do this with a Roth IRA? Don't do it. It's just, you need to do it. Can you do you have $100 million in your Roth IRA, or 50 million? If you do, do it. If you do have that much, do it. But if you have 50,000, nah, it's not worth the trouble, because you'll make pennies. It's just not worth the transactions cost if you don't want to do it on 1,000 shares. It's a good try, but not quite good enough. Any other comments on dividend capture arbitrage? But if nothing else, if you're curious, just track a big dividend paying stock on the ex-dividend day. See what happens to the stock price. So let's talk about two bad reasons for paying dividends before we end today. One is what's called the bird in the hand fallacy. And here's how it goes. Dividends are more certain than capital gains. Why? Because dividends are sticky. Let me complete the story. So investors will pay more for stocks that pay big dividends than for stocks that don't pay dividends. This is often the pitch that was given to CFOs as to why they should pay dividends. They'd get rewarded with higher stock prices. The problem there is, you're comparing apples to oranges. You know, when you pay a dividend, what happens on the ex-dividend day? The price drops. In other words, it's not dividends today versus capital gains in the future that investors are comparing. It's dividends today to capital gains today. Guess what? Investors don't reward you for paying dividends just because they're more certain. So if you're paying dividends because you think investors are going to reward you because dividends are more certain than capital gains, it's because you're doing the wrong comparison. Dividends should be compared to capital gains today, not to capital gains in the future. So that's a bad reason. Don't start to pay dividends just because you think investors will just reward you for being a big dividend paying stock. Here's the second one. You have a lot of cash this year. Why? You had a good year. You don't have enough in projects this year. You get ready to pay those dividends. I'm going to stop you. I said, be careful. Because if you paid this amount out as dividends, remember you said you don't have good projects this year, but what about next year, the year after? If you're in a good business where projects continue to come in, you're not certain about those projects, if you pay a lot in dividends or buy back stock today, you're going to regret it in the future. Why? Because issuing stock, you don't live in a Milo Modigliani world. Issuing stock is not free. There's an issuance cost. And that issuance cost can be high, especially if you're a small company. It gets larger if you're a big company, but even for bigger companies, the cost of issuing stock is substantial. So if you buy back stock or you pay dividends just because you had a good year, but you're in a business where projects continue to come in, you might be making a mistake. So don't pay out dividends just because investors will reward you because of the certainty, the burden. The hand fallacy. And don't pay out dividends or buy back stock just because you had a good year. Just think, you have to think about the future. It's not just about this year. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm sorry about the broadband problems we had early in the session. But as I said, you know, it is what it is, and I think we got through the rest of the class pretty you know, reasonably well. If you had trouble with the audio, what I will do is I will put the recording I've made on the computer on, where the audio should be perfectly okay. And you can go back and rewatch it if you want, but this is not going to be on the quiz for Wednesday. So hold back on reviewing this until you're prepared for the quiz. And I will see you on Wednesday or in office hours tomorrow. Take care, and I'll talk to you later. Any last questions before I sign off? No? Okay. Take care, bye-bye.